Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Of all the radioactive elements discovered at the end of the 19th century, the one that became the focus of incredible public fascination and entrepreneurial zeal, most of all, was radium. This unlikely element conquered the market. It was a present for a queen, it was a prize in a treasure hunt, it was a glow-in-the-dark dance costume, and it soon became a supposed cure-all in everyday 20th century life. When medical practitioners and business people alike, both reputable and otherwise, developed pretty smart ways of commodifying the new wonder element, and customers welcomed this radioactive material into their homes and all parts of their lives. Today's guest is Lucy Jane Santos. She herself is the owner of a formidable collection of radium beauty treatments, and she's also the author of the new book Half-Lives, which delves into the stories of these products and looks at the gradual downfall and discrediting of the radium industry through the eyes of the people who bought, sold, and eventually came to fear this radioactive element that was once fetishized. This is an interesting example of seeing how the views of different objects change over time, how something can become a medical cure-all, and then turns into what is universally understood as poison. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Lucy Jane Santos. Lucy, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
When I was looking at your book and the early 20th century reception of radium and how it was hawked as this miracle cure-all, I had a lot of images in my mind of how it was advertised, whether old-timey advertisements or things you would see in newspaper archives or antique stores with bottles of nerve tonic claiming a miracle cure-all for cholera, typhoid, and other diseases that were rampant in the era before vaccines. But how did you originally encounter radium as it was presented in the early 20th century, and why did that lead you down the research rabbit hole that ultimately led to the book that you produced?
Well, actually, what happened is I got sort of a very firsthand experience of it because one of my hobbies is collecting cosmetics. That's sort of my background, is history of cosmetics in general. So I go to auction houses and, car boot sales here and various places, and I buy old lipsticks and powders. And one day I went to an auction house and just bought a big box of stuff, so a big box of toiletries. And one of the things in there was this beautiful looking Art Deco-y black on the top with beautiful writing on it and silver around the side. A box of face powder, and I was so excited because I thought it would look so good on my dressing table. And then I turned it round, and it said on the back the ingredients, and one of the ingredients was radium bromide. And that really shocked me because I obviously was not expecting that. You see all sorts of ingredients in cosmetics, but not that. So I did some digging. And I found this wonderful website called Cosmetics and Skin, which is run by this man called James in Australia. And he had this whole article about radium beauty products, and I had one in my hand, and I was just absolutely, I wanted to know why. I knew that they existed, thanks to James, but I wanted to know why people would use such a product, and that basically was the question that I needed to answer, and hopefully I did in my book.
I suppose we need to get to the origins of radium. First of all, for the lay audience, what is it, and how did the audiences of the 19th and 20th centuries perceive radium, which would lead to such mania and it being used in all sorts of different products?
Well, I think it's quite important to say that I actually am a lay audience as well. When I started this project, I had very little science background myself. So I was really coming at it from wanting to understand why people were using radium products, but also not really understanding the science behind it. And when I get asked the question about what radium is now, it's really hard to sort of gauge how to pitch it, because it is a very complicated science, really. Even after years of studying it, I think I've got to the bottom of it now. But really, I sort of talk about three main headlines. Wilhelm Röntgen finding this new type of radiation that's invisible to the human eye, which ends up being called X-rays. And then a French scientist called Henri Becquerel, who wants to know whether these X-rays are found in nature, in minerals and ores. And then his research being taken up by Marie Curie. And again, I'm just glossing over years and years of really hard work and groundbreaking science, but she discovers two new elements, polonium and radium, and they behave very differently from other elements. They realize that they're actually spontaneously disintegrating, and they're changing into a different substance. At the same time, they're emanating rays, so alpha rays, beta rays, and gamma rays. So scientists don't really understand what's happening. They spend a lot of time trying to work out what happens here. And at the same time, consumers start being offered products that utilize the substance, because in particular it's radium that not only I'm interested in, but was really the big thing at the time.
What were its particular qualities that so intrigued the public and made them think it could be this health cure-all?
One of the first qualities that really got people's attention was that so the substance that the Curies were working with were the radium salts. So they were using radium chloride and radium bromide. And they had them in their labs, obviously. And they realized that whilst these salts looked like normal, common, table salt that you'd put on, because they put on your chips, but I've just realized I'm speaking to Americans, so I'm saying awfully English here. but it's common salt that, that everyone knows about. But at night, it actually glowed in the dark. And they didn't really understand exactly why at first, and it's to do with the radiation being emitted by agitating the nitrogen that's in the air. But Curie wrote about how it was one of her great joys in life to go into the workshop and see these tubes just faintly glowing. And the fact that something spontaneously glowed in the dark that didn't need to be charged in any way, because obviously there are things that glow that because they absorb the sunlight and then send out the light as light, but these salts weren't absorbing sunlight, they weren't being charged electrically or doing anything, they were just glowing in the dark, and that really, really captured people's imagination.
And I think there were glow-in-the-dark dance costumes that were one of the early products that used radium.
Yes, and this is actually one of my favourite bits of history. So it's important to say, whilst radium does glow in the dark, radium salts do glow in the dark, and it was soon realised by about 1903 that if you put a little bit of sticky substance, mixed up the salts with a little sticky substance, you could paint things and you glow in the dark. And there's really some really fun science experiments, like very serious scientific people. And they're having their very serious science soirees in London. And they're actually taking bits of cardboard and painting the word radium on them and glowing in the dark. And everyone's getting really excited. And that is genuinely people with access to radium salts, because again, at this point, radium salts are so rare. And if you're not friends with Marie Curie or someone in her circle, it's so difficult to get access to, because it's really hard to make. I mean, it's really hard to isolate. But in 1904, really, you also start getting, there's this man called Lester Gardner, and he is an alumni of MIT. And he goes on to be, he's an electrical engineer, and he goes on to be, I love this idea, because he's a really serious war hero in the First World War. He's buried in Arlington Cemetery. Now, he's a serious scientist, he's a serious person, but one of his first, it seems, projects, he set up something called the L.D. Gardner Company, and he was selling glow-in-the-dark paint, glow-in-the-dark radium paint, as he called it. And he entered into an exclusive agreement with a Broadway producer called F.C. Whitney. And Whitney had a show on Broadway, the Casino Theatre on Broadway, and it's called Piff, Paff, Puff. And reading between the lines, because it's quite, seems, even for a modern taste, you know, even looking back, it seems quite a tedious play. There's four daughters who need to be married off before they can get an inheritance, you know, that type of thing. And there's all these obstacles in their way. It wasn't particularly groundbreaking. But thanks to Gardner and Whitney's agreement, what they were able to do was the radium dance. So after all the play had finished, they darkened the theatre and the orchestra struck up a tune. And it sounds like the orchestra, the conductor had a baton that was painted with glow-in-the-dark paint. So you can imagine being in the audience, completely dark, all you can see is this baton. And they're playing a song that was specially written for this performance called The Radium Dance. And as the music starts, eight young girls, and they're probably all around about 16, 17, totter onto the stage. And they're dressed in costumes that have glow-in-the-dark paint accents. So their hat, the pom-poms on their hats, on their outfits, I think their toes, something like that. And they start this dance, and you know, it's really hard to find out exactly what happens, but they were called the English Pony Ballet, and they specialised in really synchronised routines that were said to imitate horses' movements, which is why they got their name, and that they were a really big deal at the time. This was really fashionable dancing. And they did some sort of skipping, synchronised dance, and it was all glow-in-the-dark, and it just, you can imagine how exciting that would feel and to be in the audience, because although glow-in-the-dark paint wasn't new, radium paint was the only one that didn't need to be charged up, because as I said earlier, radium just spontaneously glows, and so it didn't need an external light to make it work. So it was really groundbreaking for the audience to be able to watch this, and really exciting as well.
I'm curious how it was advertised as a treatment, because before this time, if we talk about medicine from time immemorial, which is based on humoral medicine, the treatments that doctors would come up with, Galen, Ibn Sina, others, had to do with humoral medicine, that you're trying to affect the black bile or the phlegm in the body. And I'm not a historian of medicine, and from the scattered bits I know about the early 20th century, you have the dawn of fields like nutrition, the role of vitamins are coming into play, although it's wildly misunderstood, and I think spinach is originally understood to have 10 times as much iron as it does, which leads to the Popeye cartoons. So this is the reason he becomes super powerful, because spinach is the original miracle food. So at this time, when today, if I hear the word radium, I think of radiation and someone's hair falling out and chemotherapy. But what would a person at that time in history with their limited understanding of medicine hear when they think of radium, of, oh, radiate, energy, vitality, or what did that mean to them?
So when radium starts being introduced as a therapeutic, so when it's introduced into hospitals, for instance, it is introduced as a very modern, clean technology. So it comes a few years back, a few years before radium was first discovered, X-rays were discovered, and X-rays almost immediately recently started being used diagnostically, because obviously to be able to see inside the body is really handy. And people were not, didn't take them long to realize that if you could see broken bones, you could treat broken bones. If you could see bullets, you could extract them a lot easier. And as people were experimenting with x-rays for diagnostics, they also started realizing that the practitioners would realize that their skin was being burnt. It would redden and it would blister. Some of them also noticed that their hair was falling out. So there's a principle that like cures like, which has its roots way, way, way back. They started thinking, well, if x-rays can burn healthy skin, what could they do to unhealthy skin? So it's this idea that if you had a little bit of x-ray, that could perhaps cure skin diseases, tumours, all sorts of things, really. And radium sort of comes into that a few years later, because they realised that if you're carrying radium salts around with you, I mean, Pierre Curie reports that he had a little tube of radium salts in his pocket, and it burnt his skin through his clothes. So again, bearing in mind x-rays were being, and then starts being used in a similar way, burning the skin. And it's really, so it's understood to be a very powerful radiation, obviously, because it can burn skin. It can help skin diseases, or at least burn off skin disease and tumors. So there's a lot of excitement around that. And obviously you're trying, seeing what works, what doesn't work. It's sort of medical technology here is moving very, very quickly, and they're sort of correcting their mistakes as they go along. So there's that side of things. But also pretty much along the same time, something called mild radium therapy is introduced. And so whereas strapping vials of salt, radium salts, onto your skin to burn away tumours is known as radium therapy or Curie therapy. Mild radium therapy is something different. So they found out that because radium transforms, it's the process of atomic disintegration, radium turns into radon, which is a gas, which they knew as emanation. So they worked out that radium emanation was a much gentler treatment. And that's really where the consumer products start going on, because radium salts are very expensive and very rare. Even a hospital setting, people are borrowing each other's radium. You know, it is one of the most precious substances in the world. Radium emanation is not rare. You can make it in a lab. So you can put a little bit of radium in radium salts in a sealed container and draw off the gas. And also they worked out that bodies of water around the world were actually naturally radioactive. So if you had water that flowed from a mountain and the mountain contained uranium, for instance, and uranium is a very popular substance, you find it a lot, then because of atomic disintegration, your water is actually going to end up being radioactive. And bodies of water that were radioactive were found all over the world. I mean, in Britain, we have Bath Spa, which had been known since Roman times, and they sold themselves as a radium water treatment centre. So it was quite easy to get hold of. So there's sort of two different understandings that people would have, that there is this use of the radium salts, which is very aggressive, but actually less scary than saying having surgery to remove a tumor. Because in the case of cancer at the time, you know, you either leave it or you have surgery, and surgery exposes you to a hospital stay. You know, you're opening up the body it exposes you to bacteria. It's obviously a very dangerous thing. Using radium isn't scary in that sense. It burns the skin, yes, but it's not as risky. So there's two understandings. There's the aggressive radium therapy, and then there's this mild radium therapy, which is all very friendly, really. It's going in, drinking a glass of water in a spa. It's applying a cream. It's And this is where it becomes every day, and that's the root of the mild radium therapy.
Was there a line that you could discern between reputable and non-reputable medical practitioners or business people hawking radium? Was the knowledge so limited that there's not really an appreciable line, or could you tell that there was one?
There are so many instances where somebody who seems to be what you would think of as a reputable scientist or reputable medical person goes down a route which actually, perhaps in hindsight, seems to be more on the fringes of what is acceptable medicine. But at the time, they're just working within the parameters of what was considered to be good medical practice, but also pushing the boundaries because there was so much excitement around radium. There was so much hope that it could cure cancer, that it could cure rheumatism, tuberculosis, you know, serious illnesses. So you get people like very eminent scientists, Sir William Ramsay. He is one of the most eminent British scientists. And he has a very, very sensible career. But then in about 1912, I think it is, you find him setting up something called the Bath Radium Syndicate. And he is their advisor, but also one of their directors. And they're suggesting that the city of Bath in England, which had been known as a spa town since the Roman times, and it's all Jane Austen and Charles Dickens. You know, you go to Bath and drink water and you mix with society. It's very fashionable. I mean, it got a little bit seedy, I think, by the early 20th century. But Sir William Ramsay and his syndicate suggested that Bath Council spend £25 million, I think it was, to turn Bath into a radium town. And that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to just really emphasise that Bath was where you went to get your radium treatments, and went to go swim in radium water and eat radium bread. There was radium bread being sold in Bath as well. So for me, that's kind of skirting from being a serious, I don't like to say serious scientist, but being sort of a mainstream scientist to something that seems a little bit dodgy now, a little bit iffy. And there's lots of examples of scientists and medical practitioners, you know, teaching radium therapy, practicing it in hospitals, and then setting up a business to sell it as well. And whilst you understand that people need to make money, it's when they start selling it outside of the medical world into the sort of unregulated, selling products that don't need supervision by medical professionals, that it starts to become, in my opinion, you know, heading towards quack practices, you know, patent medicine sellers, snake oil, that type of thing.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger. My workouts felt easier. I slept better. I was noticeably trimmer. There was no downside. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word UNPLUG to 30605, and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text UNPLUGGED to 30605.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
Getting out of medical treatments, I understand you own a collection of radium beauty treatments. So what are some of these and what do they claim to do? I don't know if you tried them. Do they do what they claim to do?
I haven't tried them. So in the beginning of this, I explained that one of the first product I owned was some radium face powder. Now, this product is a company called Faux Radia, who are based in Paris and launched in 1933. And they said that they had unlocked, through science, they had unlocked the secret to beauty. And obviously translating this from the French as I go along. But science was the key towards eternal beauty, essentially. And they said Faux Radia and other similar companies, so you've got a company called Radior that was based in UK and had an office in New York. And I think I've got about 40 or 50 different beauty companies on file. And they all sort of emphasized that their products were the secret to beauty. Their products were reliant on cutting edge science. They were modernity. They represented modernity. And what they said was that their products, although they don't actually say this, their products are based on the idea of mild radium therapy. So it's that exposure to a small amount of radioactivity stimulates metabolism, but also triggers hair growth as well. So you're stimulating your follicles, you're stimulating the vessels under your skin, you're stimulating the cell growth. So it's all about renewal and just by agitating your metabolism or your cells or whatever it is, you're revitalizing them. And that's how you're going to become youthful forever.
Well, before getting into the decline and fall of radium as a consumer product, there was one other point in your book that radium was presented as a present for the Queen. Can you tell me about that and what that was?
Yeah. In 1903, when radium is still really the preserve of scientists, so there's only a small amount in existence. It's being shared around between scientists who are researching the properties of radium and radioactivity, but also using it in hospitals to see how it affects the skin and the body. So you get a huge amount of excitement. And there is a scientist called Sir William Crookes, and he came up with a little device to be able to see radioactive disintegration. So it looks like a little kaleidoscope. It's about 2 inches long, a tiny little scientific instrument. And there's a source of radium salts on one end and a viewing little lens through the other. And I do have one, but it no longer works. You look through one end and you can see tiny flashes of light. So they were called scintillations of light. And that was thought to be the alpha particles hitting the screen. And people got really excited. So that was displayed at the Royal Society evening sessions. And it was a really, really cool little piece of kit that people got very excited about. But what they didn't expect was that it actually became the must-have Christmas present for 1903. And there's lots of articles, actually, in British papers, but also in papers, mostly in New York, actually, and saying about how this is the most exciting thing you can buy someone for Christmas. And one of the makers, because there were several people making these, one of the makers made a really, really fancy gold one that came in a velvet pouch. And I think it cost about £1,000 back then. It was a lot of money, but it was presented to the Queen. There was such a big deal about how the Queen was being given radium to view. And I haven't been able to find any response of whether the Queen enjoyed it or whether, you know, even bothered to look at it. But just the idea that radium was being given as sort of a royal tribute almost, I think really does show what people were thinking about it at the time. It was something of great expense, of quality, you know, something good enough to be able to present to royalty.
Well, I would love to look at the decline and fall of radium because if we compare it to something, let's say tobacco use, where for decades, tobacco was, if not thought to be completely harmless, wasn't known to be as deleterious as it is now, where you see those old advertisements that say 4 out of 5 doctors prefer Lucky Strike cigarettes over their competitors, which I'm sure is true. Lucky Strikes could very well taste better than other cigarettes. So there's no reason for doctors not to prefer them. Or they'll claim that they strengthen the nerves, like in the film The King's Speech, that George VI is encouraged to smoke. And his advisor, who's presented as a forward-thinking man, tells him to stop smoking those. By the 1960s, it becomes much clearer that there is a link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. But despite that, it takes decades and decades and decades for it to fall due to maybe it's social cognitive dissonance that because so many millions of people love smoking, they simply won't admit to themselves that it's a problem, or the vested interest of the tobacco industry that will put out fake studies arguing that cigarette smoking isn't as harmful as others would claim. But due to a number of pressures, it takes decades longer than it should have for cigarette smoking to decline and tobacco usage to decline than it would have if we were all logical automatons that only responded to reason and logic. Now, there's no multi-billion-dollar radium industry in the early 20th century, as far as I know, and I don't think there are as many people who have a vested interest in the health of radium. So I wonder if this is a useful test case, or maybe not, but could you describe to me the decline and fall of radium as a consumer product?
Yes. I mean, with radium, you've got several declines and falls, really. You've got the decline and fall of it. It's not quite the right term for it, but you've got the science world, the medical world, and the consumer world. And they all have slightly different You've got the world of science, you've got the medical world, and you've got the consumer world. And they're all slightly different in terms of when radium falls out of favor. But by about the 1930s, so about the early 1930s, you really start getting a sense that there is a growing awareness that not only is radium dangerous, but a growing awareness that the hope and the promise that people had for the substance in the early 1900s had started to fade away. So you've got, there's two big cases where radium is shown to be detrimental to ordinary people's health, because almost as soon as radium was starting being handled, scientific researchers and medical practitioners were reporting that they were being burnt by it, that they were being damaged. I mean, you've got from about 1903, people's fingers start falling off, essentially. So there's a real understanding that if you use it too much, if you're working with it in a professional capacity, you are going to be damaged by it. You might lose a finger, you might lose an arm, you might lose more than that, you might die. And there's a sort of feeling here that people are prepared to put up with harming themselves for the greater good, for science, you know, for medicine. If it can cure, if they can come for get a cure for cancer, it's worth, that's them saying it, it's worth them being disabled or even dying for the greater good. But in the late 20s, you get something else which is happening. So we talked earlier about how radium paint could be made from radium salts and a sticky substance. You start getting consumer items that glow in the dark. So it's no longer just theatrical performances and bits and pieces like that. It's watches mostly. So in the First World War, during the First World War, it was found to be really useful to have a watch that could glow in the dark, because you're in a trench. You don't want to be lighting up a match because you might get shot by a sniper. You might be in an early aircraft that doesn't have an electrical system. And it's really handy to be able to see the instruments at nighttime. So you start getting this real need for glow-in-the-dark radium watches. And then this sort of trickles over into civilian life after the war. It becomes very, very fashionable in the 1920s to have a glow-in-the-dark watch. But it was somebody's job to make these watches. So you get factories all over North America and Britain, certainly, and in other countries, where people, mostly women, are painting watches with glow-in-the-dark paint. And by about 1927, several of them have died. And it takes years for the companies to admit responsibility. But in the end, it's proven that they have died because they had ingested massive amounts of radium during the course of their working day. So as they were painting the watches, they were told to point the paintbrushes. So lick the paintbrushes to get a good point. And as they were doing that, they were ingesting the radium paint. So there was women dying of radiation poisoning. And they didn't have the attitude that they were doing it for the greater good. So whereas scientists were like, well, you know, we're curing cancer, these women were saying, we're just trying to earn a living. We don't want to die. Oh, and by the way, we've noticed the scientists in the building are looking after themselves a bit better. They're wearing shields and have modern safety, modern for the time, and safety processes. So you have those, and they're called the Radium Girls. And in 1933, you also have the death of a man called Ibn Byers, who had been prescribed Radithor, which is a radium water, a distilled radium water medicine. One of those medicines that exists sort of on the fringes of being official and being quack. And he had been drinking, well, he said he'd had hundreds of these bottles of radium water. And by 1932, he was reporting that he had terrible headaches, terrible jaw aches, and was losing lots of weight. It was investigated because his symptoms were recognised as being those of radiation poisoning, thanks to the deaths of the Radium Girls. They knew what this looked like now. And in 1933, he died, and he died horribly. And he was a millionaire playboy, so he was already well known. So that it really did hit the headlines that he had died. And it's sort of, those two cases are really the sort of, the framework for the downfall for radium as a consumer product, because although after Ibn Byers died, the American Medical Association, for instance, withdrew their approval for the internal use of radium. So they would, in 1933, the AMA said, we don't think it's a good idea to be drinking masses amount of radium anymore. So you start getting the official, ooh, maybe this isn't a good idea anymore. But the products don't, people don't just suddenly say, oh, well, yes, people have died now, let's not use it. So you actually get radium products still for another 20 years after that. 1933, when Ibn Byers dies, you get this mass flurry of radium products, actually. In France, I've got about six or seven companies that suddenly spring up selling radium beauty products, for instance, which I find fascinating. And there's this kind of idea that Ibn Byers didn't drink the radium in the right way. The Radium Girls were ingesting radium. They shouldn't have done that. There sort of seems to be this idea that we could still have a handle on radium. We've just got to do it slightly differently. And this is the idea that this is how hard it is to get rid of the hope that radium is going to cure cancer or cure tuberculosis or end aging, and will make you beautiful forever. People are really, really, really struggle to give up the hope that it could still do the trick. And it just takes decades and decades for that hope to really die.
That's very interesting that radium remains popular even though there's not a massive industry behind it. I understand today that I gave the example of nicotine. The other example we could say is sugar. Some have argued recently that the sugar industry is what funded the crusade against natural fats in the 1960s. And this led to the low-fat dieting craze of the 80s and 90s. And then it's found that processed sugar can have much more harmful effect. Beridium didn't have that. If I understand correctly, it seems like it was kept alive almost by just mass or social false hope or desire for it to be true, and work the way some claimed, even if it didn't. Is that, you think, a correct assessment?
I do. And I think I've gone a bit more into the radium beauty products than any other type of products. And you really see in the late 30s, those companies that are still producing, or at least saying that they're still producing, because, you know, we don't have these products often, so we don't know whether they genuinely did contain radium. And that's kind of not really the point, is it? Because they're calling them radium products. But in the late 30s, you're still getting lots of adverts for companies. And they say, our customers are satisfied customers. Our customers have been using us for 30 years, 20 years, or however long it is. So there's a sort of, I think there's just this, I don't think we can rule out the fact that some of these products, regardless of not whether the radium in them or isn't in them, actually is doing anything or doing what they expect it to do. Some of these products are just really good. You know, like the faux radio powder that I have, it's a gorgeous packaging. I haven't tried it, but you can smell it. It's got a really lovely, delicate perfume. I think it's a good product. I think it does what it is meant to. I think it covers your skin, leaves a pretty color. It came in lots of different shapes. There's lots of money being put into these companies to make really good quality products. So maybe some of this reluctance to give up is not just a hope that radium is going to somehow make you beautiful, but I've used this product for 20 years. I'm really happy with it. The lipstick lasts on my lips for all day. You know, I can drink a martini and the lipstick's still there. You know, so some of it is just the fact that these products are good quality. They're not cheap. The price point of these are not cheap. So they will just be good quality products that do what they say, regardless or not of whether the radium is rejuvenating your cells or stimulating your metabolism.
I wonder what the modern analogs are today and if there are lessons from radium that we can apply now, because I'm sure that you're seeing modern day things that trigger memories, or you're seeing the connections between how radium was presented in the 1930s versus other health products. And to give you an example, I attempted with my podcast to start a YouTube channel for a while, and long story short, it just wasn't worth the time to do it. But I did a lot of research on setting up successful YouTube channels and found that those who are far and away the most successful are those in the health industry or fitness industry. And I stand in awe of how they use the dark arts to build success for themselves, but ultimately to scam people, where typically what you do is you make a man the face of your health channel. If you're marketing to men, you pump him full of steroids, and then you claim some sort of ridiculous fitness system that at best doesn't really do anything different than a standard one. At worst, could get you injured based on how the movements don't work well with body mechanics. And people will listen because they think, well, this guy is ripped. This guy is in good shape. I'm going to listen to him. And then he'll sell you supplements. The supplement market is almost completely unregulated. Most of the time, it's just stuffed full of caffeine. So you do feel a physical effect, but you're just full of caffeine. And you could have the same effect if you drank coffee or tea. And they'll claim, oh, it's full of these vitamins that's going to burn fat and you're going to lose 30 pounds and build muscle at the same time. The phrase I've heard frequently is turn your body into a fat burning furnace. This is the hokey marketing that's used here. But there are other medical cure-alls if we just got a fitness. Without angering too many fans, I've heard claims that detoxes and cleanses are sometimes a little bit questionable and your organs can do that well enough. And it's not as if there's a mild poison in your system that just needs the enough blueberries to dislodge it. And then you can detox from this or that thing and have perfect health and never have cancer, all that. But there's plenty of dubious health claims that perhaps are only increasing in the 21st century. So do you think there's any lessons from what you saw studying the history of radium that can perhaps inoculate us against some of these more outlandish health claims that are being thrown around today?
I'm not sure there is, actually. I mean, one of my primary motivations when I started writing the book was every time I'd seen radium products being mentioned, there were all these sort of, back then it was sort of BuzzFeed or, you know, like those types of websites where it said 10 dangerous things that our ancestors used to do. And the subtext is always, but we're not so stupid to do now. And I really just kept thinking, every time I saw one of those lists, and radium is always on the list, I was thought, well, you know, there's so much that we do now that we just do not understand and or willfully choose not to understand as well. And I think detoxing is one of those things. It just sounds sensible. It sounds sensible that if I eat cucumber, if I liquidize cucumber and have that for a few weeks, of course that's going to help, isn't it? I can feel that my liver or whatever it is going to thank me for that. It just feels like it should help. And one of the things with the radium is that you can kind of see that again, can't you? You can see that, well, all these scientists are using it and it's being used in a hospital. Of course it must help. So I'll just, you know, have this little bit of radium water. That will do the trick. And I just think, I don't think anyone's learned anything. I think it's exactly the same now as it was then. And even then, you know, radium's not the first product or the only product that's being sold at the time on a similar thing. I mean, up until the late 1920s, arsenic, for instance, you see adverts for it all over magazines and newspapers, arsenic complexion soap, arsenic complexion powder. And, you know, that really gets me thinking as well, because I've seen several magazines where arsenic powder and radium powder are on the same page. You know, what are these people doing to themselves? But arsenic is working on the same basis as well. You know, that it's this, a little bit of what's bad for you is going to stimulate your metabolism. And in the case of arsenic, one of the early signs of mild arsenic poisoning is that it makes your cheeks flushed. So you can see how people washing their faces with arsenic soap would be like, oh, this is working, isn't it? Because my cheeks are flushed, and flushed cheeks is youthful, isn't it? That's what we want to be, you know, we want to be, have a little coy redness. And you can read, well, I guess what I'm saying is you can read arsenic poisoning as being healthy because it's mimicking something that you associate with being healthy. And I think that's the thing that we're still doing now. You know, detox or Botox, you know, we don't know what it does necessarily long term, but it's mimicking what we feel is healthy, what looks visually appealing now. And I can't see a world where that hope and desire that to come out of it okay, to come out of it beautiful, to come out of it young, isn't just such a really powerful motivation. And also there is just this sort of, I don't know if it's laziness or disinterestedness, but just looking about my desk, I've got some hand cream here. And if you look on the back of it, it's got, I don't know, about 15 different ingredients that I wouldn't even hope to know what they are. And I don't know whether they are doing anything dangerous to me. I hope not. You know, I would say that I trust the regulations, although I definitely don't. But at the end of the day, it feels nice. It smells nice. You know, my skin does feel smoother after it. So I'm going to carry on using it. And that's just sort of hope over knowledge, I guess, isn't it?
Right. Well, that's an excellent point that in some ways, we're not doing things any differently than what our predecessors were doing a century ago. And I think also by looking at a story of something that we know is dangerous when it's consumed in a certain amount of quantity can maybe help take the blinders off of the types of products that we consume today. So it's a great way to consider things with a different perspective. Well, the name of the book is Half-Lives, The Unlikely History of Radium, and there's a lot more to get out of the story than we were able to get into this podcast. So for listeners who want to check that out, that's where they can find it. Lucy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second.
Our spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, the McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraza. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.